But first, an interview that drew a huge response from those gladdies and poddies that like making things, especially the engineers amongst you. And I began by speculating what life would be like without them. In a world without engineers, no skyscrapers, no steel, no elevators, no houses, no sewers, no phones, of course, no internet, no TV, no cars, probably not carts, just as well, because there wouldn't be much in the way of roads or bridges. Engineering, says my next guest, Roma Agrawal, has created the fabric of our lives. It's shaped the spaces in which we live and work. Yet our engineers, unsung heroes, few of us spare them a passing thought. Roma, a young Indian-born structural engineer, famous for her work on London's iconic skyscraper, the Shard, is on a mission to change this with her new book, Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures, and she tells the human stories behind some of the world's most eye-catching buildings and urges us to see the world through different eyes. Yes, the eyes of an engineer. And Engineer Roma joins me from London. Welcome to our little radio program.
Thanks for having me.
The first thing that strikes me reading Built is your passion for building materials themselves. And I'm going to start with a quote. Others, you say, might feel the irresistible urge to pet a little kitten or handle an object in a museum. But for me, it's concrete. Doesn't matter if it's a smooth, stark grey surface or one with little stones visible or one left intentionally rough. I have to know what the texture feels like. Roma, when did you discover this irresistible urge to stroke concrete?
It's one of those odd things, isn't it? I was probably doing that from the time I was a little kid, because I always loved playing with different sorts of toys and blocks and materials, and I was building things. But I would probably say the concrete obsession really started once I moved to London and actually started studying engineering, because of course we learn about different materials. But there was always something about concrete that I found really fascinating. You know, the fact that it starts off as, you know, an array of different types of rocks, you then burn them, you turn it into a liquid, and then you can reform it into any shape that you want. And I just found that completely fascinating. So yes, you know, I'm often wandering around London or on holiday, touching different types of concrete.
I remember on my first trip to Moscow decades ago, discovering that the concrete that holds the Kremlin together had eggs added to it. I understand that this is not an uncommon procedure to add blood or eggs or sticky rice.
That's right. You know, different cultures have been adding different types of materials into their concrete mixes. So I was really fascinated to learn, for example, that the ancient Romans used to mix the blood of animals into their concrete, and they believed that this helped it behave better when, you know, it would freeze and then it would thaw and so on. I know about the Great Wall of China. So the portions of the wall which are made from stone have mortar between the different pieces of stone, and that mortar has sticky rice in it. And that helps a little bit with the movement because it's starch. And the final great example that I have in Built is the dome of the Taj Mahal in Agra in India, in which they mixed all sorts of stuff. They mixed fruit juice and gum and egg white, and they had this wonderful mix that they called Chuna. So it's been absolutely fascinating to me that there's all these different types of organic and inorganic materials that have been mixed into concrete. I love that it's got different recipes.
Well, take the Taj Mahal. Is that interesting sort of menu that you describe? Was that the result of trial and error, experiment over many, many years?
I expect that different people from, you know, different parts of India or different parts of the world did experiment with all these different types of material and probably found that, you know, some bits worked better than others. You know, they reacted differently with the atmosphere, that some were more long lasting. I definitely think it was a trial and error type of, you know, decision that was made. I'm sure there was some scientific research done as well, but that's not something that's really survived through the ages. So it's not something I've been able to locate, really.
You describe yourself as being a geeky child, not surprising when you consider Dad was an electrical engineer and Mum a computer programmer.
Yeah, that's right. So I grew up in a very, very scientifically literate sort of household. And my mum used to program in COBOL in the 1980s when, you know, that was probably quite an unusual thing for her to be doing. And my dad, you know, worked as an electrical engineer and he used to design laser readers. So they both had very interesting sorts of jobs. And me and my sister growing up, we used to play with cranes nearly every weekend, and we used to build stuff and then take it all apart. And so my flat that I live in London, my sister's home, my parents' place in Mumbai, they're all full of these different toys that we've been building, and some of them are 20, 30 years old. And I just love them. I love that we used to do that as a kind of regular occurrence.
Roma, when you were studying physics at Oxford, you saw engineers designing specialist equipment. Tell me the story of the metal holder for a lens.
So I was sitting in the University of Oxford's physics department in one of the specialist teams, and my job was a rather boring thing, which was to go around the entire department and log where all the fire safety features were. So now every once in a while, the engineers that sat around me probably felt a little bit sorry for me and said, oh, you know, here's a little problem that you can entertain yourself with. And the one that really particularly stands out in my mind is this problem of a small glass lens, which has a steel holder, and that entire mechanism needed to be cooled down to about minus 70 degrees Celsius. So you think, oh, you know, that's quite an easy solution. We can just create some kind of holder and it'll all be fine. But when you think about the way the different materials actually work, the glass won't contract as much as the steel. And so there's the danger of the lens actually cracking if it's too tightly held by the steel. So I had a bit of fun trying to think about, well, how can we actually design this tiny little piece of this huge maze of machinery in such a way that it works at all different temperatures? And I think what really sparked my interest here was the fact that this was a tiny, tiny little aspect of a much more complex, you know, system, all of which needed designing. And it needed to work on that micro sort of level, but it also needed to work as a whole entire large unit. So that really, really sparked my interest in engineering.
Roma, let's extrapolate that to the shard. Tell me what it was you actually did for that monolith.
Yeah, so two of the bits that I found most particularly interesting, one was the foundations and the basement of the tower. So we actually in London have fairly poor ground because we're on the banks of the River Thames. So we have quite wet clay, which can dry and it gets quite saturated at other times of the year. So it's not very pleasant material to work with. So one of my big challenges was how do we build this large basement? So it's three stories deep, kind of in the middle of central London, right next to the river. And we had, you know, the underground train lines running next to us. We had a bus station, a train station, a hospital across the road. And how is our work actually going to impact all these different structures around us? So that was one of my first challenges. And then the second one that I really enjoyed doing was the very top of the tower. So if anyone visits London and goes up into the Viewing Gallery, what I'd urge you to do is to look up at the steel and not worry about the view so much, because the steel is far more attractive than the skyline of London. And what you'll see up there is about 60 meters of completely exposed metal. You can see every bolt, every weld, every beam. And how we decided to build that was really, really interesting, because it's the highest piece of steel that we ever constructed in the UK. But at the same time, because all the steel was exposed, it had to look amazing. So that was another, you know, absolutely wonderful challenge that I worked on that tower.
Does it irritate you that the architects get the glory?
It frustrates me, that's for sure. We work so closely together. So the architects come up with the vision and we really enable that vision to become reality. And that's such an important part of the design process, because without, you know, the practical design, without the maths and the physics and all the technology that we use to make those visions a reality, they wouldn't really exist. So, you know, as you say, that's part of my mission, is to make sure that engineers are recognized for the fantastic work that we do. And part of that's because we just don't get enough people studying engineering. And I think that's because of a lack of interest or awareness as to what it is that, you know, we actually do on a day-to-day basis.
My guest is Roma Agrawal, structural engineer and the author of Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures, published by Bloomsbury. I'm old enough to remember a time when people were thrilled by engineering feats, even the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which I can glimpse of, I stare out the window, was an engineering masterpiece that people were thrilled by. Utzon's Opera House, just over the road, required the most dazzling engineering to make the thing doable. It hasn't always been the case, has it? Because very often, in the 19th century, for example, engineers were heroic.
They were. So those two structures you mentioned, the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge, are two of my top structures in the world. Actually, I absolutely love both of them. You know, I kind of love the curves, I think, particularly. I love the arch on the bridge as well. But you're quite right. So, you know, we know in the UK that engineers like Isambard Kingdom Brunel, they were showmen. You know, they were out there. They were talking to people, to politicians, to the general public. And they were celebrities in some senses of the word. And somehow over time, that seems to have changed. My theory is that that kind of golden age of engineering, where people could really see the change in their lives that engineering was bringing them, happened about 100 or 150 years ago. So there's an, you know, great example I talk about, which is the sewage system in London, where before the sewage system was actually built, tens of thousands of people were dying of cholera every time there was an outbreak, which is, you know, an absolutely awful, tragic way to live. And they could see that once this large sewer system went in, that those cholera epidemics basically stopped. So I think there was more of a recognition, you know, of the everyday person, what the benefits of this engineering was to their daily lives. I think now in the developed countries in particular, we've sort of lost that, because our engineering, it pretty much works. And so if it's doing its job properly, we don't really hear about it. We only now hear about it when things go wrong, unfortunately.
I can think of a case of something going wrong, and it was in fact a pyramid. People don't realise that there are hundreds of the damn things, you know, all stretching all the way down the Nile Valley, from very little to ginormous. But the famous Bent Pyramid comes to mind, where halfway up the damn thing started to fall over. And so the engineers had to change the angle of the pyramid to give it stability. What other failures can you think of? Is the Leaning Tower of Pisa a failure?
Yes, that's an example of things going wrong with the engineering. And you know, my understanding is that it was going wrong sort of as they were building it and very soon after. So there was a problem there with the ground. And, you know, the ground is often one of the very uncertain things that we work with, you know, when we build things out of steel or concrete or brick, we know how that's going to perform. What we struggle with a bit more is, well, what's the existing conditions that we're kind of trying to mess around with in some senses. So one of my favorite stories that I found in my research was when I went to Mexico City. And my historical research told me that the original city that was built by the Aztecs was actually built in the middle of a lake. And this was because of a religious sort of symbol that they were searching for, which was an eagle sitting on top of a cactus with a snake in its beak. So a pretty specific symbol, which they found in the middle of a lake, and they decided that they would build their new city there. So basically filled in over time this lake with soils and materials. So it's obviously very, very wet. So the entire center of Mexico City has actually sunk by about the equivalent of a three-story building in the last 150 years, which is completely astounding to an engineer like me that's, you know, completely unfamiliar with that scale of movement.
Another great folly, of course, is Venice, and that's an engineering triumph. And it will require engineering genius to keep it there, won't it, as the waters rise?
That's right. So the combination of the sinking and the waters rising is a really big challenge. And, you know, this particular cathedral that I visited in Mexico City had actually tilted by quite a long way as well. So it had sunk, but it also tilted. And the engineers carried out this really meticulous operation of actually removing soil from underneath this immense cathedral to try and stabilize it and to bring it back. And because they found that technique was very successful and the cathedral is doing fantastically well now, they did also try those techniques on the Leaning Tower of Pisa that we were talking about previously. I'm not sure that technique would actually work in Venice because it's a slightly different challenge that they've got there. But, you know, I just find, I love the fact that they did this operation in Mexico, which is now being tried out in Italy. And, you know, me in the UK has read about it. So I love that kind of international aspect of engineering as well.
Tell me about the Burj Khalifa, which I understand is now the world's tallest building at 829 metres. How do these mega skyscrapers actually work?
So the mega skyscrapers have so many different aspects that have kind of come together at this crucial point. We saw a big set of progress happen in the 19th century, in the, you know, the late 18th century in some cases as well. And, you know, it's material. So it's the fact that we are able to manufacture cheap and very strong steel. We've talked a little bit about concrete. Computing plays a huge role. So we are now able to analyze forces and materials in ways which we simply couldn't without the existence of computers. So these megatall structures wouldn't exist without technology. But I also love the story of the engineer that's called Fazlur Khan. And he grew up in Bangladesh and he moved to the US and he was actually somewhere between an architect and an engineer, I quite like to argue, you know, technically a structural engineer. And he basically flipped the way that skyscrapers were designed. So until he came along, skyscrapers generally had something like a tree trunk. You know, they had a central spine that when it was windy or there was some kind of force coming up against it, then, you know, this spine or this tree trunk would keep it nice and stable. And he said, well, hang on, what if I put that stability system on the outside of the building? And I compare that to skiing, you know, without the poles that you use in your hand. So that's the old skyscraper. And then when you add the poles to your hands and you feel a lot more stable, that's a bit like the Fazlur Khan system, where he basically made the outside of the building what keeps it stable. So the John Hancock Center in Chicago, with its big giant X's on the outside, is what keeps that structure stable. And those are the kinds of systems that then led to the Burj Khalifa being built. So, you know, we've had to change a lot of the fundamentals of the way we design in order to achieve these megatall structures.
This extraordinary building with an exoskeleton, is that the upper limit?
So I find that question really interesting because people often ask me, well, how tall can we actually build? I think the exoskeleton is the right system. It probably needs to be combined with other systems the taller and taller we get. So we need to have multiple different ways of keeping things stable. I think ultimately it comes down to how big the base can be. So we can see that with the Burj Khalifa, where the base is large and it tapers as you go higher and higher. And I think that's the system that we'll see is, you know, the kind of triangular overall shape. So then you start to ask the question, well, how big would you make the base? You won't get daylight coming all the way in. How big is too big? Yes. How would you get people up and down? So, yeah, the questions kind of keep pouring through. But, you know, I believe you could build essentially as tall as you want, depending on how much time and money you had.
Is there not an aspirant at the moment to go even higher?
So there is a tower in Saudi Arabia that's being built at present, which they say will be over a kilometer tall. So they're smashing the record of the Burj Khalifa. What happens after that, I'm very, very curious to see. But yes, we are going to quite soon break the 1 kilometer mark, which is just astounding.
And that, of course, would give some people a different sort of aspiration. The Twin Towers comes to mind. You point out that it wasn't simply the impact of the aircraft that caused that catastrophe, that vast collapse. It was an engineering issue that hadn't quite been foreseen.
It was quite a complex thing. So, you know, we sort of look at it and we think, oh, there was a big hole in the side of the building caused by the plane, and that must have destabilized the building. And to an extent, that's correct. But fire obviously plays a huge role in safety, and it's something that, you know, we absolutely have to consider. So what I find really interesting is that the designers of the World Trade Towers actually did anticipate a plane collision, but they did it for the biggest plane that they had in the time, which was smaller than the planes that ultimately tragically hit it on 9/11. But it was also the amount of fuel that was in the plane that caused fires to basically rage in the building afterwards. And I think what's really important is to note that after these kind of horrific collapses that we saw, that the engineering community has really changed the way we now design for safety. And that's partly in the use of materials. So we now tend to build all the escape routes out of concrete, which is a much more robust and protective material than having, you know, these boards, which is what they had in the Trade Center towers. And we also think about, well, if we did have the worst happen and there was a hole in the side of the building, how do we make sure that the weight which that missing structure should have been carrying, how can we channel that elsewhere to make sure that these large-scale collapses don't happen anymore?
I suddenly have an image in my mind of a building going up like a vast torch in the middle of London, a catastrophic misjudgment about cladding, an engineering problem.
So that's something which obviously is still being investigated. And I think what I feel is that there were multiple issues that all came together and caused this, you know, absolutely awful incident. So, you know, again, us engineers are absolutely going to wait and see what the investigations reveal. And trust me, we will be learning from that and applying that to our designs.
Going back to the tallest building on Earth, the Great Pyramid, and it held that record, heavens above, for millennia, very big base, very small top. When does this passion for verticality begin?
I mean, it's something that I think humans have aspired to for thousands of years. So part of it could have been spiritual or religious. You know, you're kind of trying to build a stairway to heaven or closer to God, for example, in the religions and cultures that believed in that type of thing. I then also found it really interesting, again, that the Romans, ever the practical engineers, thought about rising populations in their cities and how were they going to, you know, house this growing number of people. And so they built what we, you know, I would call them high rise. They went up to 10 stories at a time. Again, we had no computing or, you know, modern methods of construction. And they built these 10-story structures without lifts, which housed thousands and thousands of people, had challenges with collapse and with fire and with so on. And we see that now. We see the big kind of the signature projects. We see a lot of development happening in countries like China, for example, which I find really fascinating. Again, I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that people are flocking towards living in cities. And in fact, by 2050, the vast majority of the Earth's population will be living in these megacities. So there's a challenge in how we make our cities cope with that level of density.
I want to come back to the personal stories in your book, Roma, because it's clear that many of the world's great engineers were, in fact, quite eccentric. Tell us about Brunelleschi.
Yes, so Brunelleschi was an Italian engineer, and he very early on, I think he was pretty young, he may have been a young apprentice at the time, he said that he had two big ambitions in his life. One was to bring engineering back to the glory days of the ancient Romans. And the second one was to complete the dome of this cathedral that was being built in his hometown of Florence. So the story of this basilica, the Duomo, is a fantastic one where they started building this huge structure and they just simply left a hole in the middle for the dome because they didn't know how they were going to build it. And people came along with all sorts of different ideas. And Brunelleschi had a really good idea, but he wouldn't want to tell anybody about it because he thought, oh, someone's just going to steal my idea and I won't get to actually do the work. So there's this great story of him going to one of these big kind of competition days with the people that wanted to get the dome built. And he says, you know, I challenge anyone in this room to make an egg stand up on its end. And loads of people tried and they all failed. You know, every time they tried to find the, you know, little center of gravity of the egg, they couldn't make it stand up, understandably. And then he goes along to the front of the room and he kind of smashes the egg down slightly so that one end of it breaks, and he created a bit of a stable base. And he said, there you go, that's how you make an egg stand up. And then everyone else said, oh, well, you know, if we knew that we could break the egg, then we would have all done that. And he said, exactly, you've proved my point that anyone will steal my idea if I tell you how I'm going to do it. And that's how he ultimately won the commission to build the dome of the Il Duomo. And what an amazing job he did of that. It's, you know, one of the very popular tourist attractions in Italy even today.
You tell some extraordinary stories of women in engineering. You describe Brunel's sister Sophia as the great engineer we ever had, and cite Emmeline Roebling as one of your idols. Tell me about Emmeline.
Yes, so Emily is a particular hero of mine. So she grew up in a family that really actually encouraged her to get an education and to study all sorts of different subjects. She visits her brother during the Civil War and falls in love with one of the officers in his group called Washington Roebling. And they get married after the war. And she sort of starts her married life. Well, I mean, I would say, I say as a typical Victorian housewife, but she actually spends her honeymoon with her husband in Germany studying how to build caissons, which is a type of chamber you can use to build foundations underwater. So there was always this kind of little thread, a little spark of interest in engineering that she had. So they moved back to the US, and the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, the amazing, iconic, almost symbol of New York, is commissioned. And it's her father-in-law, John Roebling, who's asked to do that. But the family suffers tragedy. So John Roebling actually dies because of an accident on site. And her husband suffers from caisson's disease, which we call the bends now. So we know when we go diving that we shouldn't surface too quickly. Otherwise, we get the bends. And Washington Roebling actually contracts that disease and becomes very disabled. And essentially, she takes over the project slowly but surely. She doesn't kind of launch in there. She starts by taking notes. She starts by writing letters to people. Then she starts learning cable theory, complex mathematics, about steel, about how they're going to string this giant deck across the river. And for 11 years, she runs the project in her husband's name, of course, through lots of different challenges, through being sued, through people dying on site, and finishes the project, and then was honored to ride with the president of the US across the bridge as one of its very first passengers. So amazing, amazing woman.
And of course, you want to recruit many young women to the cause.
I do. So, you know, the statistics in the UK, I don't know the statistics in Australia, unfortunately, but in the UK, only 10% of engineers are women. So, you know, we have a long way to go to get anywhere close to gender parity. And the reason I'm really passionate about this is because what we're doing, you know, engineers are designing things for society. You know, we're designing homes, we're designing spaces, offices, schools, and so on. And I think it's really important that as designers, we actually represent the population that we are designing for, and that, you know, we can do the best work and the best design if that's the case. So I really believe that, you know, we need a fully diverse workforce in designing our cities, and that's part of what I'm trying to do.
A very persuasive argument, Roma, and thank you for making it on our little program. Roma Agrawal, structural engineer based in London, the author of Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures, published by Bloomsbury. Good on you, Roma.
Thank you so much.